Hey, Ragnar, thanks for coming on and talking with me today.
Good to be here.
So you recently released your memoir From Punk to Monk. How's it feel to have that wrapped up and have that out into the world?
It feels good. It's sort of like what it must feel to have a baby. You've sort of
Yeah.
like it's sitting there and you're working on it and you're building it and you're driving it and people are cutting it down and cutting out editing it and you're going back and doing a rewrite and finally it comes out.
Yeah.
It feels like, whew, it's over. And now they
How
just
long were you working on that?
Probably because I have a sort of a crazy schedule usually, so I'd have to block out times of my year to work on it. And I'd say about a little over 4 years, probably.
What was your process like going, like trying to figure out what to keep and what to trim? It's like you had a lot in there, but also like you could tell like there's just a lot to the story over the years.
There's two, they cut out 200 pages.
Yeah.
Which was not my idea, but I've never edited my own book anyway. So they were like, nope, you don't need it. It doesn't help the arc of the story. It doesn't add anything extra. All the stories are cool, but you got to cut the fat a little bit. So for me, it was, I wasn't the editor. I'm just sort of
Okay.
a storyteller, and I told it in little chunks, and I tried to sort of create a bridge from one chunk to another and
Yeah.
tie them in. And that sort of was the process for me. Tell little stories and try to string it together.
Yeah, and then they went in and like tried to, polish it to have some kind of a
Yeah.
like an arc specific that it would fit into.
I hear some noise in the background. Is that you or me?
Yeah, that's me.
Okay.
That's my
You good
laptop's
with
going a little bit.
you good?
I'll have that
It's
cut.
okay. As long as you're okay with it, I'm okay with it.
Yeah,
I
we're
sang
good.
for a punk band. I can deal with any type of noise.
So speaking of that, you were one of the pioneers of the straight edge movement and punk. Do you want to talk a little bit about what that philosophy was and why that resonated with you back then?
Sure. I came from a if the context of it was the 80s, which was corporate rock, arena rock, and I just wanted to find my own path, and part of finding my own path was a lifestyle. So the punk music was an alternative type of music where kids created their own music. They didn't just like go see some big bands and sit in a huge arena. You go to clubs and then you perform yourself and you book your own tours and you write your own magazines and you put out your own records. So it was a really a DIY undertaking, and so it was sort of impressive. You didn't wait around to get a record deal. You just figured it out and did it. There
Yeah.
was something very empowering about that. And the New York punk scene there in the 80s was really into drugs and really I mean, like the lowest type of drugs. And I was really into clean living and positive living. And so the phrase was coined straight edge. And the first time I heard that, like in 1982, I was like, well, that's exactly what I am. There was no real straight edge scene, but I just felt like, yeah, I don't drink and I don't smoke and I want to control my mind and my senses. That's what I'm into. And it sort of put me on a spiritual trajectory. And later on, when I started my own band in 1985, and that became sort of like the foundation of our band, and that's just sort of like we felt like, it's a good thing, it's a positive thing, and we'll sing. That'll be the subject of our ideas, positive thoughts, this idea of what goes around comes around, clean living, and it was just sort of our thing. I never thought it would turn into like a phenomenon. And it became a phenomenon, and it became without even thinking of it or going to school to learn how to do it. We branded this entire type of look, which was sort of an island with in an island of the punk scene. You had the punk scene, which was sort of like ripped jeans and mohawks, and sleeping in the streets, and giving the finger, and then you have the straight edge scene, which is sort of like clean cut. Collegiate looking, bright eyed, athletic. And it was still the same type of music. The music in the Venn diagram, the music crossed, but the philosophies were much different. And so even though I grew up in that punk scene, I lean more towards positive thinking bands and bands that are more about personal change than yelling at the government to change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, how was that received in the beginning, and why do you think it took steam later on?
Well, again, we weren't planning on like making movement out of it. We were just sort of like, this is our thing, but it sort of took off. And with anything that sort of takes off, it got a lot of pushback. It got a lot of pushback from the punk scene, both in America and Europe, and it also became a little bit of a, and then right when everyone finally accepted it, we upped the ante again and raised the bar. We said, okay, and we're all into animal rights and vegetarianism. And it was like, even the straight edge fans were like, what are you talking about? We got to jump through this hoop now also. And so some of even the straight edge people rebelled against that. And so, whatever, we believed in it. We thought it was important. We thought it was part of our personal evolution. So we wrote songs about it. And again, it's one of those things when you really sort of dial into your values and find out what's important to you and what you think is actually a movement towards good, you're going to attract people. And then you're also going to find haters that hate your guts because you're challenging them and they don't want to hear about it and they don't want to change their ways. Now, decades later, it's those were just genuine principles of how to live a healthy life. You know, you control your senses, you control your mind, you learn how to forgive people, you eat healthy, you take care of your body. These are these things, if you didn't do them when you were 25, you're going to do them hopefully you're doing them by the time you're 45, because you can't keep on getting drunk every night into your 40s, or you're not going to have a successful marriage, successful family, etc. So I feel like I was lucky to get clued in on these things and get some inspiration on these things at a young age. It probably saved me from God knows what.
So you had kind of this base already. Like it seems like very similar ideas to some of the spirituality and philosophy that you had ended up going deeper into.
Sure.
What was it about the Hare Krishna movement that that you were attracted to that seemed to like take it a step further than you had already been?
Sure. I was interested in a very broad understanding of spirituality. I felt like there's spiritual traditions from all over the world. So I could appreciate the Bible and got a lot out of it. I grew up with it. But I also appreciated other teachings from other traditions as well. And the way that the Indian or Vedic teachings are is they are very broad-minded. They are inclusive as opposed to exclusive. They're not trying to convert you. Matter of fact, if you said, "Hey, I'm a Christian and I want to go to your temple," they'll be like, "Oh, that's great that you're on a Christian." They'd encourage your Christian path. So they see the teachings is there's one divine being, and religion is just a process of rituals to get to that divine being, and that divine being sends teachers or messengers to inspire us, to give us, show us some light. So according to the Vedic paradigm, when you hear about Jesus or you hear about Buddha or you hear about Muhammad, these were teachers that have come to teach truth. And if you follow the truth, you'll become more and more enlightened. One of the pitfalls on that path is becoming arrogant and becoming hateful. And I've seen that happen in all different types of circles. When people fight for betterment of their nation, betterment for the environment, betterment for animal rights, betterment for religion, they initially started off to because it's a better way to live. You know, care about the whether it's Democrat or Republican, it's on both sides. Or if you care about your religion, you care about animal rights, they become so into their cause, they start to hate those who are not like them. Mm-hmm. And that type of fanaticism has no place in an inclusive concept of spirit. And so that is the problem I found, not with Christianity, but it can be easily woven into any type of doctrine. So I do see fundamentalist Christians, Islamic people, fundamentally saying my way is the only way and everyone else is doomed. It's just I find that is a very shallow way to understand spirit. And so I was never attracted to it.
Mm-hmm. So the Hare Krishna movement was more open to different ideas and just kind of like letting people in rather than
Sure. It's not just the Hare Krishna movement. It's Sanatan Dharma in general, which is the whole teachings of ancient India. Hare Krishna movement is just sort of a coined phrase for theistic followers from India who came to America. There was one theistic guru, teacher, who taught basically theism. A lot of times when you think of Indian philosophy, you think, well, it's not, they're not theistic. Jews and Christians, all these Abrahamic religions, they're theistic. The Hindus, they're worshiping like trees and rivers and monkeys and what the hell. But 33 million demigods. But actually, what's difference between, say, what we call Hindus, which is a misnomer, by the way. Hindu is not a Vedic word. It's a Western word made up by the Greeks for people east of the Sindhu River. But what we find as, what we know as Hindus, we think of them more to be like pagans and idol worshippers. At least that's how it was taught when I was in eighth grade in social studies class. But I'd say, I think Wikipedia says like something like 67% of Hindus are theists because they believe in one supreme god and multiple demigods. So in the same sense, you know, someone might argue, well, there's no demigods. There's no higher beings. There's just me and God. First of all, atheists will say there's just no higher beings. Mm-hmm. And then I would argue with that. Well, what about the sun? The sun is a higher force than you. The wind is a higher force than you. The ocean is a higher force. See, in Vedic thought or Eastern thought, every entity is a person, is a being. So the trees are beings, the blades of grass are being, the cockroaches are being, the cats are beings, but even the wind is a being and the planet is a being. So what's happening is once you start putting beingness in what we would consider things, you know, who looks at a forest and sees beings? Only very thoughtful, spiritual people. Otherwise, people just see it, oh, this is an asset. I can get so much lumber from this. I can cut these down. I can build on this. I can sell the lumber off, and then I can build real estate. I'll build condos here. So when we start to objectify beings, you have the makings of hell on earth. And that's what any war propaganda films will do. When you're going into war and you see the enemies, they'll dehumanize the enemies, these propaganda films. Why? Because it's easier to kill them. When you look at a cow or a pig as a thing or a commodity instead of a being, it's much easier to kill. It's just a thing, right? But we give personhood to our dog. We give it a name. We give it a jacket sometimes. We sleep with the dog. So what's the difference? One is because we've invested beinghood in the animal. And another thing is we've taken away that beinghood and it just becomes a commodity. It just becomes a thing. It just becomes an object that we can buy or sell or consume any way we like to. It's so the Vedic paradigm is every living entity is a being, and therefore it has to be treated with type of dignity. And you can't completely get rid of violence on this planet, but violence can be minimized. And so we try to walk on this earth creating as little violence as possible. That makes sense?
So, yeah. Is that the thinking behind vegetarianism and veganism?
Yeah, the thinking is that these are living beings. Why are we gonna unnecessarily kill them? Now, someone could argue, say, well, it's because a Christian has argued with me. I think I mentioned this in my book. Well, because it says in the Bible we have domain over our animals. And then I would argue, well, I'm a father. I have domain over my children. Does that mean I can do whatever I want with them? No, it means I love them, I protect them, I nurture them. That doesn't mean I just consume them or do whatever I want with them. And another person may argue, well, what's a big deal? It's just an animal. You eat plants too. Yeah, you're right. Although a lot of plants you don't have to kill. Just right now on my windowsill I have a bunch of romaine lettuce stubs, because you can cut the romaine lettuce and plant them in water and grow it back. So you're not killing the plant. Oftentimes, in the cutting and the pruning, you're enhancing the flower, the fruit, the leaves, etc. Sometimes there is killing in a root vegetable. But what you're seeing is this is something much different. than the killing of a sentient being. And if you don't believe me, put a knife to a potato, or put a knife to a cow. You know, right? See how many children would kill a cow before they kill a tomato, or before they kill a carrot. There's something in more an evolved species. So we try to minimize the violence as much as possible, understanding ultimately that we can't get rid of it all.
Right.
Just to exist, we're causing violence. Mm-hmm. And there's some karma for that.
It's an effort to reduce as much like clear or noticeable suffering as possible. Like even though like we don't really know what's going on with plants, but like we can tell more that there's, at least it's easier for us to see that there's more pain and suffering involved in killing animals.
For sure. I mean, trees communicate through, trees communicate with each other. If you put a chainsaw to a tree, they send signals to other trees what's going on. It's unbelievable. The more they study it, the more faith I have in the very teachings I've been raised on.
So like the idea that they're conscious and like have more intelligence than we initially gave them credit for.
Well, we give them no intelligence. We give them, or some completely base intelligence. But the fact that scientists now realize trees are in communication with each other, they weren't teaching that when I was in high school. You know? Yeah. So yeah, we're seeing things in a much different paradigm. Even the concept of animal rights or vegetarianism, it's in the conversation. It wasn't even in the conversation when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. You know, it was if you're a vegetarian, you were a weirdo when I was a teenager. You were a freak.
That's crazy.
But now you can go to Burger King and ask for vegan options at Burger King. It's like, come on. So things are changing. The world is polarizing. And sometimes we get stuck in our ways. I can say in my own life, I was stuck in my way. It was hard growing up Italian. I ate meat every meal. But there was something very similar to what I was saying to you. It just stuck with me. Like, how can one animal, my dog, be a being, and another animal, say a pig, who's not that intelligence is no less than a dog and a pig. How can one be a being and one be a thing? And it started killing me. It started driving me insane. And I was like, am I becoming like a sociopath here that I can pretend like one? You know, sometimes you'll see that. A person will murder somebody, and then they'll go out and have dinner with somebody else, like the murder never happened. Right. That type of split personality is the mind of a sociopath. And we should understand that's what we're doing when we are calling some animals beings and other animals things. We're cultivating the mind of a sociopath. What do you think about that?
About like where to draw the line?
No, what do you think about that? Like we're cultivating the mind of a sociopath when we're developing some animals are good animals, we'll let them live, and some must die.
Yeah. When I'm talking about like drawing the line, I think it's difficult to. I mean, I eat meat. I haven't gone down the vegetarian or vegan direction, but it's definitely a difficult situation where like we don't like animals. It's much. It's strange like that we have some animals that is perfectly fine to eat and others that it's not. But I also think that it's weird. It's going to be weird moving forward as we learn more about plants, like how we're going to think about that too. Because I wonder how much the difference is. And then you have like fungi, which kind of like bridge the gap between the two, and like they seem to have more intelligence. So do you, maybe like those big mycelium patches?
Yeah.
Do you think that'll change your thinking at all as we move forward and learn more about plants? It seems like it'll just get like even more difficult because like the more we learn, the more it seems like they're all intelligent.
I understand. And like I said earlier, you can't exist without causing some violence. So we try to minimize it. So in this tradition, whatever you harvest, you take as an offering and you offer it back to God. So you know what? And Krishna says, leaf, fruit, flower, water. You offer those to me and I accept them. And with that, he accepts the karma from them as well. Because there's some karma in me plucking, chopping, snipping those vegetables, because there is some karma there. It's not completely karma free. Karma free happens when you offer it back to God. Anyway, that's the philosophy behind it.
Yeah. And I thought the idea was really interesting that the way that it's prepared, or like the way that you get the food, makes a big difference. Could you touch on that idea?
Sure. The idea is, and I think it's pretty understandable if you look at the idea is that the karma of the consciousness of the cook goes into the food, especially grains. Why? Because you're consuming the energy or the consciousness of the cook goes into that food. So whoever's preparing that food, you're consuming. And you're consuming their consciousness. So the idea is you want people of high consciousness and are cooking it as an offering of love. And you're consuming that offering of love. Just like if a mother was to prepare a food, it has a different vibration. Or a father. My father was the cook in my house. But it has a different vibration, a home-cooked meal, as opposed to fast food. It's a different type of metric of health, actually. Food prepared with love. And that's our diet.
A thing that you mentioned earlier that I wanted to touch on was this, like how vast the I guess literature or scriptures are in the Vedic tradition, and these ideas of all these different deities. What are they trying to get across or teach in that? Also, like what are those beings to them?
What are the beings? They're just higher beings. They're higher beings that have some type of universal affair in the material cosmos. And then there is the God of all the gods. In a Judeo-Christian culture, we'd say God, Allah, or Jehovah. But in India, they would say Bhagavan, Krishna, Ram. It's the same being, but just, you know, different names. Just like you can call me Ray, you can call me Raghunath, you can call me Raghu. Same guy, different names, depending on who's talking. And but there's actually beings that are higher than human beings, but they aren't quite, they're not God. Just like if you work in a factory and you and me are putting on the bottle caps of Coca-Cola, and then we have a manager that's above us, and that manager can like give me a raise, or he can fire me, but then he has a manager, and that manager has a next level. It's like a multi-tiered business model, and of course there's an ultimate CEO at the top who's running the show. So there's different levels of universal management, so to speak. If you study what we call Hinduism, you'll hear about the big guns, so to speak. You'll hear about Ganesh. You'll hear about Shiva. You'll hear about Brahma. These are the bigger, more famous ones. But then there's other higher beings that are, there's 33 million. Some are local. Some are out of this universe. They have a very interesting cosmology and understanding of the universe in Vedic cosmos, which is that the living beings are everywhere. They're not just on the planet Earth. They're on every planet. They just have different forms. But they're like on our planet, our forms are made up of earth and water. On other planets, you could have a being on the sun. And you might say, well, how could a being exist on the sun? Well, their bodies are made of fire. That's how. It's quite simple. If your body was made of fire, the sun's a great place to live. And the next question would be like, well, how can that be? My answer would be, how could it not? Why not? I'm not even saying it does. I'm saying that's what they teach. But could it be? Could beings have bodies of fire? Sure. I have a body of earth. I have a body of salt water. It's affected by the moon. Come on, why couldn't you have a body of the sun? What do we know anyway? What do we really know? There's beings. For example, suppose there's an ant on my computer. I'm sitting right in front of the ant on my computer, and he has no clue I'm even looking at him. He has no clue that we're doing a podcast, even though he is right next to the podcast, right next to the computer screen. Now, you're a reality. I'm a reality. The podcast is a reality. But the ant with all of his senses, will never be able to look you in the face. Why? It's just beyond his sensory experience. Empiricism means nothing because his empirical subjective view is completely different than our subjective view. So we can say, well, we went to the moon, and guess what? By the way, if we went to the moon, I'm just going to put that out there. If we went to the moon, because I just went I went to the Air and Space Museum not that long ago, and if you look at that spaceship, you'll be like, there is no way that thing went to the moon. It looks like a high school diorama.
Pictures and stuff.
But that's a separate thing. So, but even if we did go to the moon, how do we know what we saw what was on the moon?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
What if everything in the moon was either incredibly tiny, and we're just looking for things that look like us, that are our size, that are our shape, that are our, right? Or like an ant. The ant is right in front of my face. It can't understand that I'm here. So what if we are ant-like people, so to speak, meaning our senses are also limited? How can I have perfect understanding of what's going on if I have limited senses?
Mm-hmm.
I have a limited eye in the same sense that ant has a limited conception of reality. He can't help it, even though he tries. Even if I build him an ant telescope, he'll never figure it out. He doesn't have those senses to figure it out. There's certain things he can't perceive.
How much of the teachings are like trying to provide accurate descriptions of these other realities compared to just like opening our minds to the idea that we just don't know everything? Like how is it possible to come up with these ideas? Like where do you think they got them?
They're considered just descriptions of the universe, and they're just passed down from sages who had inner visions.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's not one particular person. It's literally like volumes and canons of mystical beings from ancient ages. And the things they say, and it fits within a certain context. Like if I pull a carburetor out and say, what's this? If you don't know it in context, it just seems like a weird carburetor, just like you don't even know what it is. And then if I pull out another piece of the engine, but when you put it in the engine, it makes sense within context. So sometimes you'll hear study of the demigods, study of the higher planets, study of lower planets, study of earthly planets, which are somewhat in between, and then study of metaphysical things, mystical things, genealogy of higher beings, of mystical powers. And then you start to hear of places outside the material universe, like there is like vast amounts of spiritual light. And then there is where that light is emanating from, planets where that light is emanating. Now, this isn't even of the material world anymore. And then there are even more refined places. See, everything is even, it's more and more nuanced. It's not like a very simple way to say, well, there's heaven and there's hell. They say there's millions of heavens and there's millions of hells. And all of those places are temporary. And even the heavens and hells are not the spiritual world. That's of the material realm. So it just goes into great detail about these things. And it's not to, you know, criticize the Abrahamic teachings. Mm-hmm. If anything, it enhances their teachings. They can fit together in the Venn diagram. They could all fit together. Although they might not, they may argue it doesn't fit together. No, Jesus is the way, or Buddha is the only way, or Muhammad is the only way. It does actually fit together. There is a cross. There is an evolution of the soul, and it takes sometimes lifetimes to do it. And sometimes the idea in the Vedic thought is we are here to evolve. We're not here to have fun. We're not here to party. We're not here to, you know, make a good amount of money. Everything here is temporary, and we're here to learn lessons like we are almost in a prison. And sometimes life can feel like a prison too. It's like, and I think sometimes it's safe to say that if I don't learn my lesson, I have to Have you ever had this where you got to learn that same lesson again? Whether
oh,
it's a lesson of friendship or a lesson of loyalty or a lesson of, you should be loyal to your spouse and, oh, God, what did I do? Whatever it is, we're all here to learn lessons. And if we don't learn those lessons, then we have to come back and learn again. And so that is the evolution of the soul or the de-evolution of the soul, because we can also go downward in our human species.
With so many of these ideas, like how do you manage all of them? And like, what's your approach to like practicing and trying to apply these ideas? Like how much of an influence does some of the metaphysical and mystical aspects play for you?
Some of the things, good question. Some of the things are very, very easily understandable, like meditation, chanting, kirtan, worship, having an altar in the house, cooking your food, offering your food, distributing that food, study of wisdom literature, changing your habits, rising early. All these things make practical sense.
Mm-hmm.
Do I understand that Ganesh is a higher being or that Brahma is the creator of the universe? I can philosophically understand it, but can I prove it? No. Could he be? Yeah. Could there be a creator of the universe that is not God, but also a powerful living being? Can there be powerful living beings more than me? Yeah, I know a lot of people are really smarter than me. I know a lot of people are stronger than me. A lot of people are, more beautiful than me. Can there be higher beings that are not even of human species? Sure, why not? I think so when we enter into the Vedic teachings, we're not asking for people to throw away discernment. You have to incorporate discernment. You have to incorporate discernment, and that's how we sharpen our intelligence. If I tell you, look, Jake, just believe everything I say. It's going to be good. There's a God. You're going to die, and God's going to save you. Don't worry. All this shit that's going down right now, God loves you, and God's going to take care of you. It's going to work out. That's sort of just like faith, like a father mm-hmm. giving faith to a son who's scared. But if I say, here, take these practices, apply it to your life, see how it works. Control your senses, see how it works. Change your diet, change your habits. You got some bad habits, clean up those and see how it feels. And then if all these things I tell you, you're like, you know what? That makes sense. I'm going to try it. Then you take a little step further. What else do you think I should do? And I'll say, okay, try adding this to your life. Ah, interesting. Okay, I tried that. That worked too. What else should I do? So faith is built in small increments. It's not blind faith. It's reasonable faith. In the same way, I walked out my door this morning and there wasn't a boulder that fell on my head. Do you know why? I have reasonable faith. Could a boulder have fallen on my head when I walked out the door? Yeah. But I have reasonable faith because every day I've walked out that door, no rocks have fallen from there, right? There are times where I've stepped on a rake and it smacked me in the head. And since that day, I've been very careful around rakes on the ground. So I have a reasonable faith that there's nothing dangerous when I walk out that front door that's going to attack me. Although that is, in one sense, you could call that, well, that's blind faith. Well, yeah, it's blind faith, but it's also reasonable. It's reasonable. So in Vedic teachings, the teacher asks the student to try something out. Generally, the student first says, what do you think I should do? And the teacher says, well, try A, B, and C, and apply it to your life, and come back in a week and tell me what you think. Stuff like that. And that's how we move forward in our spiritual path. Do we have old habits that keep us down? Sure. Do we have real deep woven habits that we might have not just been practiced for this lifetime, for lifetimes? Sure. We could have been practicing things for lifetimes. And then all of a sudden, my teacher, my guru says, no, you shouldn't do that anymore. It's not going to be good for you. Well, it's hard to give up something I've been practicing,
yeah.
Right? For 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 5 lifetimes, 100 lifetimes.
Yeah.
So, right?
So it's a process of just kind of like validating a teaching for yourself, making sure that works, and just kind of inching forward one step at a time.
Exactly.
And inching instead forward of just like, instead of just trying to like adopt everything all at once.
Inching forward is a great way to put it. If anybody adopts this culture and philosophy all at once, I think you're crazy. I think you're just like some weird blind follower, and don't join a cult because you're going to be your prime candidate for a cult or an abusive relationship where you're just looking for anybody to follow. And whenever I meet people like that, I feel like it doesn't matter what happens to this guy. They just better be lucky enough to find somebody good they're in a relationship with, or they join a club or an institution that is kind to them, because they've thrown away all discernment and they're just looking to join a club, basically.
Yeah.
But you can't have that in a real spiritual path. You need discernment to grow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point, because the cult stuff is a real problem, and you know, there's plenty of like spiritual ego issues that can creep into all this stuff. How do you avoid that? Are there teachings to help people kind of like ward off that threat?
Sure. Well, there's two ways to look at it. From the side of the student, you got to worry about your own ego, and you got to worry about the ego of the teacher. Does the teacher have an ego? And as a teacher, you got to worry, okay, if I really want to teach this properly, I can't teach this with any ego. And so the ego is always sort of, you got to be careful. And if the teacher ends up flexing his ego or her ego, they're not getting the benefit either. The joke's on them. It's not like they might have cheated somebody, but they really cheated themselves, because there is a goal. There is a ladder to climb. And if you're investing in your ego, you're not going to win the game here. So in my own life, when I'm a student, in front of my teachers, I act like a fool, you know, because when you're arrogant, you can't receive. Because you already know, just like you talk to a teenager. Yeah, yeah, Dad, I know. Yeah. I know, Dad. Okay, you know nothing. But
yeah, back to me in a few years.
So humility actually attracts information. Humility attracts spirit. Humility attracts God, and it attracts wisdom and knowledge as well. Whereas arrogance repels God, repels information, repels knowledge, and repels our spiritual life. So when I'm as a student, I try to adopt a humble, open-minded, broad-minded understanding. It doesn't mean I throw out discernment. There's also a check and balance. Also, the check and balance is the teacher has to say something that's in line with their guru, has to be in line with the sacred literature, which is coming down for millennia, and it has to become in line with previous masters. So, for example, if I was to tell you, okay, you're going to be my student, it's okay if you want to eat chicken. Well, you could say, well, wait a second, what does your guru say about that? Oh, my guru said you can't. I can't just start making stuff up. And so there's a check and balance and accountability with, they call it guru, sadhu, the previous masters, and shastra or sacred literature. And there should be a check and balance before we, there should be some type of check and balance before we hear from our guru. We want to make sure our guru is also bona fide. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's got to be some bona fide teaching and not just some cult of personality.
Sorry, I'm not distracted by the thumbs up.
That's just okay. As you
finished that sentence. I wanted to go into chanting. I think kirtan is fascinating, and just other forms of chanting as well. Because there's more than just kirtan, right?
Well, there's japa, which is almost like what the Christians would call like rosary, where you're chanting mantras on beads. Like, and then there is kirtan, which is loud call and response singing.
Yeah. So, what does that that practice aim to do? Like, what does that do for you? And can you touch on the idea that you've written and talked about the way that sounds impact like our thinking and the way that we act?
Sure. Kirtan is considered a way of if you have a window and you have a sun outside the window, and sometimes people don't wash their windows, and if you don't wash your window for long enough, like an abandoned house, you can barely see the sun. So chanting's compared to Windexing the window, cleaning the window to let the light in. And the idea is that we are all filled with light. We are beings of light. We're beings of God. But the window's covered. It doesn't shine through us. Now, sometimes you do see people that, and it's almost like they radiate. It's almost because they've been on a spiritual journey. And then sometimes people have a darkness about them. It doesn't mean they're evil. It means they're a spiritual being, but they're covered. And so no matter where we're at, chanting works as those scrubbing bubbles or the Windex to clean the mirror or clean the window of the mind. And when the mind is clear, then all of a sudden we can feel what we actually feel like. I actually feel joyful. It's hard to feel joyful when the mind is covered. And how does the mind get covered? It gets covered by resentment, gets covered by anger, gets covered by rage, it gets covered by lust, it gets covered by greed. We live in the future, we lament for the past. So a big part of the yoga process is to uproot all of these things so we can just be with the self, which is considered divine. You had a two-part question was, and oh,
The way that sound
oh
it
yeah.
like impacts and shapes us.
Sound is one of these things that, whether you're a spiritual person or not, you can see how it's not just in vibrations have effect on the consciousness. Like words are not just words; they're power packed with meaning, and they affect our consciousness. They affect our feelings and our emotions. If I was to, there is such thing legally called hate speech, and there is such thing called falling in love with somebody over a few words. Someone could say something, you'd fall in love with them, and someone could say something and you hate their guts. You can gossip or criticize people, and you can feel horrible after a good gossip session. Or you can appreciate people and glorify people and start to talk about someone's good qualities, and that'll affect not only you, not only affect the person that listens to you, but anybody that listens to that conversation. So sound is so powerful that it starts to create the psyche. And we say in the West, you are what you eat. And if you eat clean foods, healthy foods, it has an effect on the body. But if you hear healthy thoughts, healthy words, healthy music, healthy mantras, right? Then what that does, it creates a healthy mind. If you hear minds of victims. Oh, this is horrible. How could this happen? Why me? And you start to imbibe victim speech on a regular basis. This is unfair. It'll affect your consciousness. You'll look at everybody as trying to take something from you or hurt you or cheat you, and the world will seem unfair, and it will affect your outlook on life. So we want to put things in us that make us stand taller, feel a little stronger, feel better about life, feel grounded. We don't want to put things that are going to sort of create more problems in our consciousness. So we got to eat, super foods. You have to have super thoughts because our thoughts are real. Our thoughts can really wreck our lives. Our thoughts can ruin, even if we have good fortune, it can ruin it. And our thoughts can also liberate us.
What's your hatha yoga practice like?
My hatha yoga practice has changed over the years. Now it's very minimal. I think my focus now is more on a meditational practice with japa. But for years it was, 6 days a week, 2 hours a day. And I still think that's a good thing, but there now it's a little bit more balanced. It was a good time of life to do that. Now I think to do what I did then would be a little bit more extreme. So you have to sort of go with the ebbs and flows of the seasons of the body as well, or else in the name of doing some pose, you're trying to compete with your 35-year-old self. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, why shouldn't I should be able to do this still? And, you know, you lose every year, you lose some poses. It's okay, because we're not the competitive nature should be gone when we're doing asanas. We shouldn't even be competing with ourselves. Mm-hmm. We should be thinking how to make this vehicle more suitable for the soul.
Okay.
Because the vehicle itself is a gift, and therefore I want to maintain the gift.
Gotcha.
So if I was neglecting the gift, so to speak, that's a problem. But yoga is one of these things that complements everything that you do.
Mm-hmm.
So I travel a lot. Yoga complements that. You know, I like to work outside, and sometimes, you know, today I was like lifting some big rocks and stones and stuff like that. And yoga complements it. You know, I know how to bend over. I know how to grab a rock. I know how to stand with that rock. I know how to throw the rock and roll the rock and stuff like that. So yoga complements everything you do, whether you're just do yoga or whether you're a snowboarder, etc. Because it's real regular maintenance. I call it like the detailing of a car. You're not just like polishing the car that everybody sees. You're like getting every little detail of that vehicle. And that's the beauty of yoga.
Yes. So the like the strength and flexibility part, and even the cardio, because I think it's kind of an underrated form of cardio sometimes, because like you can really get your heart up. So like all of that it's just a way of like preserving and appreciating the body and like keeping it in good enough shape so that like some of the physical problems that can come up don't like interfere with like the greater spiritual work of yoga.
Right.
Like, sure. Yoga.
I mean, it depends what you want out of it. The yoga system sort of got something for everybody, but the well goes very deep. If you just want to take care of your body and find reasonable health, you can find that. You know, mm-hmm. if you just want to be a little bit more mindful, a little bit more thoughtful, yoga system can do that. If you want to do mystic powers, the yoga system has that there. But if you want to go very deep into who you are underneath this frame, you know, that's where the yoga system ultimately goes.
Yeah. What's your view on breath work? Like, how do you approach that? And like, what's the purpose of that for you?
Just like a physical practice, it has sort of a threefold system. One is a cooling, one is a heating, and one is a spiritual. So the asana practice to the regular physical practice or the meditational practice, it can be for your health benefits. It can be for or a spiritual benefit. Okay. Sorry, it said reconnecting.
Yeah, me too. I got that.
Okay.
I think we're good.
Okay. So yeah, so pranayama can have a cooling effect on the body, can have a heating effect on the body. It can even have a spiritual effect on the body.
Well,
another note, people use it also for mystical powers.
Yeah, how's that work?
You have to have a teacher that teaches it to you. But they can do... Anyway, mysticism within yoga is pretty interesting.
Yeah,
and it's usually given by one of the demigods. Worship of the demigods. We in bhakti, we don't usually shoot for the mystical powers, but I've been around enough people to know that they exist.
Yeah, so some of the stuff that you've said about like the charts and the mind reading and the palms and stuff, this it's fascinating.
It's really fascinating. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable because we live in a world that doesn't make, but when you start hanging out in those circles, you see that people have some abilities, and some stuff, it's the people who are doing the Jyotish or the astrological charts. It's some people, it's as if they've been doing them for lifetimes. They're so acute to it. And then there's people who do, truthfully, any of these arts, some people, they're, you know, just by probably there's some things that you excel at. You know, when I was little, I played the violin. I didn't excel at it. I played it for years and I just never got that good. Then I've seen people pick up a violin and just become great at it.
Yeah.
Because, and the idea in the yoga system is it's not new to them. They've had some familiarity with it for lifetimes.
Do you want to touch on what you guys are doing over at Super Soul Farm
Sure.
and some of like the events and you mentioned the travel that you offer. You want to touch on that stuff a little bit?
Sure. We have events at our farm. We do weekend retreats. And that's on my website, raghunath.yoga, RAGHUNATH.yoga, if you go to events. And we just do a few events a year here. It's basically either kirtans or weekend immersions in bhakti or yoga trainings, yoga and kirtan weekends. It's sort of like a spiritual yoga retreat center. It's cool. It's a small community. And we hold about 25 to 50 people. It's super sweet and it's down home and that's cool. But every year I take a group to India on pilgrimage. We go to holy places in India. That's very transformational. If a person's into this philosophy and lifestyle, I wouldn't recommend it for sightseers or I wouldn't recommend it for backpackers. It's people who want to go on a pilgrimage of holy places. Even if you don't know about it and you want to learn about it, it's very educational. And we do it a lighter version of the same thing, and I say lighter because it's in Nepal, and Nepal, of course, was at one time part of ancient India, but it's in the Himalayas. So even people who are not so into like all the Vedic teachings just want to trek through the Himalayas. That's a great trip too. We do morning teachings and evening teachings, as well as a lot of kirtan on the whole trip. And kirtan in India and Nepal is incredible because everybody really appreciates it. Whereas, like, if I'm doing kirtan in New York City, people are like, "What?"
Yeah.
But Nepal is a great trip too. And this autumn, I'm doing both of them. You can sign up for one, or you can sign up for both. And then January, we do a big educational month. We do a 300-hour and 200-hour teacher training. We do a kirtan study, and we do a lot of yoga teachers take that. And then we do people are really into kirtan. They learn the clay drum, the mridanga, it's called. And then our podcast does a training where we study sacred literature. So there's a lot of trainings going on that happens in January for pretty much the month of January, either in the whole month or in 2 week periods. That's also all on my website.
Cool. Is there anything else that you would like to let people know about?
Our web you can check out if you're interested in the spiritual stuff. You can check out Wisdom of the Sages, available anywhere you get podcasts. We have a huge, wonderful community, some that listen like every day, and it's like a daily podcast.
That's cool.
It's good to it's good to check it out if you have questions, and it's not taught in a real boring way. It's very lighthearted and fun, but also very deep at the same time. And we started in 2020, January 1st, 2020, and we are about to hit our 1300th episode tomorrow.
Nice. That's cool.
So it's been a good journey.
Cool. Thanks a lot for coming on and talking today. And I enjoyed meeting and talking to you. It's a privilege, so thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, my friend. Let me know when it comes out, and I'll help you promote it.
Yeah, will do. Thanks, man. I
Okay,
appreciate it.
brother. Bye-bye.